What's up, everybody? Hope you're doing okay. I'm giving away a free copy of a book to listeners. The book is The Great American Suction by David Nutt. George Saunders calls it elegant, manic, deeply attentive. The reader may be struck at first by a dark undertow, but as the language teaches us how to read it, The Great American Suction reveals itself to be a celebratory comic romp from a big-hearted writer. Gary L. Lutz says, life has burned a hole in the pockets of Shaker, the aptly named up-and-atom, down-and-out, wambling his way through the full spread of our present squalor in this ultra-vivid, live wire of a debut novel. Page after page, David Nutt shocks the language into a killingly original blaze. So, giving this away, to win, all you have to do is tweet at selectedprose, one word, about either your favorite interview thus far or someone you'd like to see on the show in the future. So do that. I also started a Patreon with $1 and $3 options, each with their own benefits, including but not limited to a chance at winning signed copies of your favorite books, a monthly newsletter of writing advice, and mentions and or promotion on the pod if you're working on something or trying to get the word out about your book. So there's that link in the bio, and as always, I appreciate you listening. All right, welcome to another episode of Selected Prose. I am extremely honored to have the opportunity to speak with Darren Strauss. He is not only an incredible author, but he's also my teacher at NYU in the MFA program, and I've learned so much from him. And so it was really a big opportunity for me to sit down with him and talk to him here about writing, about his career. He's just brimming with excellent advice, and I think you're going to get a lot out of this one. First and foremost, I want to let you know that Darren Strauss is the Queen of Tuesday, which is perhaps 2020's best-reviewed novel, hits store in paperback on May 25th. Do yourself a favor and go pick up a copy. The Queen of Tuesday is a follow-up to Darren's best-selling National Book Critics Circle Award winner, Half a Life, and it was a finalist for the Joyce Carol Oates Award in Fiction. And, I'm really sort of blown away with the range that Darren has shown in his career, and he talks about that and where he started and working with E.L. Doctorow and kind of approaches to fiction that we haven't really heard on this podcast yet that I find extremely valuable. So enjoy the episode, and as always, let me know what you think. Follow us on Twitter at Selected Prose, on Instagram at Selected Prose, and email us at selectedprose@protonmail.com with any questions or concerns or what have you. But without further ado, here's Darren.
Thanks for reading the book, man.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's awesome. And
I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
I like it. Sometimes, you don't know, but I like this one.
Yeah, I was talking to your publicist, Tracy, and
And
she was telling me that you got a lot of, cool book tour stuff lined up. And
There's no book tour, but there's
events.
TV stuff. Yeah,
TV stuff.
Yeah, so that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it's really cool because, I have yet to read all of your other books, though I will.
No rush.
But when reading about them, this almost seems like a culmination of everything that you've done in the past.
That was my attempt. Are we on?
Yeah, we're on. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's been on. I'll cut all the other stuff out.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I had no idea. Yeah, that is what I was trying to do.
Yeah, so it's like, because there's so much to talk to you about in terms of craft, and I guess since this podcast is about craft, and you're my workshop teacher at NYU.
And the grade is not in yet.
It what?
And the grade's not in yet.
Oh, man. Yeah. This is just me schmoozing to get an A. No, but it's like, you've tackled so many different, I guess, types of writing. I mean, not only do you write nonfiction, but then you've written Half a Life, which was a memoir, and historical fiction and biography.
I think that, I always admire people in other fields who can do a bunch of stuff. Like, I love, the 3-tool player in baseball who can, field, hit, and run, and the musician who can play all different kinds of music. And so I just felt like it would be kind of cool to try a bunch of different things. So you don't get bored. And that's why this book took a long time, though. This book really did take much longer than my other books. I mean, some of it was other factors, outside factors. I had some health issues. My son had some health issues. But, you know, I was like, how am I going to make it work? That it was part memoir, part biography, part historical fiction. And then it was also contemporary fiction, which mm-hmm. that storyline got cut out. So I mentioned this to you before, but the book is like 320 pages, but initially it was 620 pages. Like it was a massive, like infinite jest size
wow.
beast.
And what's the contemporary storyline that you cut out?
So, I guess I should say for your listeners that in the book now, in between the chapters, there's like interstitial stuff, which is a contemporary story about me, basically. And that's a fictionalized version of me. So that's 11 pages now, 12 pages. That was initially 300 pages. I just basically, it wasn't working. I knew I needed something to deepen the historical story and tie it to the author in some way. So the reader would know that it meant something to me as writer. But it was just too much, and so I thought, I'll just take like the best 11 pages of those 300 pages and see if I can make them work. Now, that's not quite true. Like, there was a whole action storyline with like a scam and internet startup. It was like a much more comical storyline. Mm. It was sort of this madcap adventure story, which just didn't work in this book. And I really kind of knew it for the last 100 pages, but I just sort of kept going.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of those frustrating things. Actually, I don't think I could have written the book without it, so it's not that frustrating, but, you know, that's like 2 years of work down the drain.
Yeah.
At least.
When you think of it that way, yeah. But maybe you had to do it.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, my wife was always like, if you'd just shown it to me, you know, just showed me the book, I would have told you. But I didn't show it to her. My wife was a book critic and is a writer herself, and so she's a very valuable resource, but I didn't show it to her until it was done. For some reason, I wanted just to finish it and then show her, and she's now like, yeah, that was a mistake.
Excuse me. Wife knows best.
Always.
Yeah. For people who haven't read it yet, it's called The Queen of Tuesday, and could you maybe just take us back to the beginning, like, general premise, what's it about? And
yeah, it's a book about, it's sort of an odd one. It's the story of Lucille Ball, the television star, and she was a very cool lady. She was not just this actress, and she was a great actress, but she also was the first female executive in Hollywood. So she had tons of power in an industry at a time when women did not have power. And she had the first interracial, or intercultural, I guess you should say. It was seen as interracial marriage back then. I guess you wouldn't consider it now. But she sort of forced CBS to accept her marriage to a Cuban man, which was also very progressive at the time. So it's her story. It's basically a biography of her golden period. And then it's a family memoir about my grandfather and grandmother in that same era. And then it's a fictionalized story of their sexual affair. Mm-hmm. Which that's totally invented. So it's two nonfiction stories twined together with this fictional conceit.
You know, I'm sure you're going to be answering this question a lot, but what was the research process with that? And also, what is it like trying to envision your grandparents' sexual life?
That was the fun thing. Like, I did this whole interview for the Daily News where the guy was just kept asking, like, what's it like when anybody, your grandfather, having sex? I was like, yeah, I don't know. It was, you know, well, I'll get to that in a second, I guess. But the process was, I studied with Neil Doctorow at NYU, where I now teach. And that was a huge thrill for me, being a student of his and then a colleague. One of the things he said, which I always remembered, was when you're writing a novel, to do the least amount of research you can get away with. And some people totally dispute that and think it's not a great piece of advice. But I've always found it helpful because I think the rationale behind it is if you're doing research, that will control the story you write because the research will dictate what you write about. And I think, you know, if you're writing fiction, you want the story to come from your head, and you want the imperative to be entertaining or whatever, or enlightening or whatever you're trying to get across. You want that to come from your brain and not from some outside book. So I felt like I knew Lucille Ball and I knew my grandfather well enough to at least start. And the way I do it is I write until I get stuck, and then if I need research, I'll stop. And I was lucky in that I was hooked up with this this great program from Hunter College called the Hertog program, where, and if you're a writer out there and you're listening, you should apply to it, where they will give you a free research assistant. So they, someone gave them money, some endowment, to pay their students $10,000 to work with a writer for a semester. Mm. So the person gets paid $10,000 to work for you 1 or 2 days a week, so it's a good deal for that person. And it's a great deal for you because as a writer, you can say, yeah, you know, I want to find out, tell me what the set of Lucille Ball's show looked like. And for me, I also, it's also the story of my grandfather losing all his money. So my grandfather was born into this business where he should have been very rich, but he wanted to be a writer, and his father was this Russian immigrant who said, no, you have to follow the family business. So his business was real estate. So he owned a bunch of, he owned a bunch of high rises in Manhattan. Mm. Like it would be impossible, you'd think, to lose money if you own that kind of real estate. But by the time I was born, all the money was gone. My grandfather was flat broke.
Wow.
But so it's also the story of that. So I had the research assistant look up, hey, what buildings does my grandfather own? Where were they? And all that kind of stuff. So that was kind of awesome. And, you know, I talk about this in nonfiction classes I teach. You know, you and I work together for a fiction class, but it's true in any book. I always say, you know, if you're going to tell a story, you have to sort of go for it, right? So a lot of students would come to me and say, you know, I want to write about this, but I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, or I don't want to tell this one part. And I always say, then you're not ready to tell the story, because you have to commit to the story if you're going to tell it. And there are plenty of times where you're just like, I can't tell the story. Like, I have a number of stories I would never write just because I don't want to hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
But once you commit to a story, you have to go all the way. So I was writing this story, which was about a sexual affair, and it's about, you know, passion and doing things for losing your head, doing bad things. And so I felt like I had to have passionate scenes in there, or it wouldn't really make sense. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to this moment, I thought, well, I guess I need to write a sex scene. I also thought, I haven't seen many good literary sex scenes lately, so mm-hmm. I took it as a challenge to be like, okay, do it in a way that's not, you know, offensive or misogynist or all the problems with so many sex scenes from male writers of the past.
Mm-hmm. Were you intimidated by that prospect at first?
Yeah, I was intimidated by the whole thing.
Did you have to read, like, countless sex scenes to try to figure out what was going wrong with them?
No. I mean, I read a couple just in my life and thought, oh, this is like Norman Mailer's, you know, John Updike scenes where you thought, what are you doing, man? And, you know, John Updike, great writer, you know, but I think sometimes people lose themselves or whatever. They're victims of the times, or maybe they just have blind spots. But I always think, just don't think of it as a sex scene. Just think of it as another scene where people happen to be doing something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you don't write a scene of someone eating ice cream and then stop and have, like, 20 pages of offensive description of the ice cream cone melting in your hand, right? So it's like, okay.
An over-description of unnecessary details.
Yeah. This person's eating ice cream, so I'm going to write about that and not overdo it. And this person's having sex, I'm going to write about that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have to talk about everything that's going through her, you know, every inch of her body, or every inch of his body, or every inch of her brain, or, you know.
Yeah, so, I feel like film can get away with it. I don't know why we haven't been able to crack the code.
I think there are some that are good, you know. But yeah. A lot of writers don't try, either. Mm. But I'm trying to think, like, writers I love. I've never read a Laurie Moore sex scene, or, excuse me, or Nabokov didn't do a sex scene, or Toni Morrison. You know, I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
It was a crazy pornographic Kafka novel.
Is there really? No, I'm just kidding. Oh, I was like, what the hell? I know the guy liked porn, so... Apparently he had all these, like, photographs, like, he was, like, in... Well, maybe I'm just, like, slandering him on the end.
Yeah.
But I had read that somewhere,
you
so...
You can cut it out, you're in charge. That's so funny.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And just speaking of, like, authors that you love, someone the other day mentioned that you were influenced by Celine.
Well, yeah.
Because he writes some smutty stuff occasionally.
I'm not hugely influenced by him. I just... So I studied with Doctorow, as I mentioned, and Doctorow assigned his book.
Which one was that? What, Journey to the End of the Night? Yeah,
and that's something you would never do today, because he's a Nazi.
Right.
And he, you know, he's offensive in there. And Doctorow was Jewish, and I'm Jewish, and I just thought there was something interesting about that. Where, you know, he said, I guess you would say it was like a 90s version of a trigger warning, where he's like, you know, this is offensive, but there's stuff to learn here.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get a lot out of it. I just, the freedom of it, like, he's just a crazy writer. He'll go as far into it, he'll just let his imagination take the story in crazy places. So, you know, I often think, and this is something David Lipsky said once in a lecture, I thought it was really interesting. It's a good way to think of it. He said, he didn't want to read a. There's a book that was bigoted, and he was going to put it down. And they thought, you know what? There's a lot I can learn from this book. And so, if I don't learn what I can from this book, then bigotry wins twice in a way, right? So, if you acknowledge, okay, this book is bigoted and gross, and I wouldn't like to have dinner with this person, I can ignore this part of the book, but I'm going to get what I can get from it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I had a student once who was writing a fantasy book that was very close to the. To Lord of the Rings, and she wouldn't read Tolkien because he was a bad guy. And I said, you know, that's letting him hurt you in some way, because, mm-hmm. like, you can learn a lot from that book. And then you could take your own version of Tolkien, which he probably, if he was a bigot, he probably would be bummed by anyway, so it's like a kind of revenge, mm-hmm. in a way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but no, I'm not hugely influenced by Celine. A writer that I'm influenced by that no one reads, though, is V.S. Pritchett.
Yeah, you've mentioned V.S. Pritchett before, and
I love him. And he's sort of forgotten. He was a great short story writer and critic, and he wrote a couple of novels that were not quite as good. But he had a very long career, and he's sort of forgotten. But he was born in 1900. He died in 1997. So he wrote for the whole century. Mm-hmm. There's a book that came out when he was like 85 called As Old as the Century. Like, he just kept writing forever. He's a great model in that way. It's kind of like a British Chekhov, mm-hmm. but more stylish, and he's just sort of forgotten. But that was a great, that's one of the great, one of the things I'm most proud of in my career was that I was able to convince Modern Library to put out a book of his that was out of print, and they let me write the intro. So So like one of my favorite writers, I got a book of his in print, and I'm attached with it. So I feel like I did him a service there that made me feel really, that's the kind of thing where you're like, oh, this, because it's a tough field even if you're doing well, so sometimes you got to be like, okay, that makes it worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the Pritchett book? Is it still out?
Yeah, it's called Mr. Beluncle. It's not one of his best books. I would say, if you're a fan, definitely read it, but I would definitely read his stories first.
Okay.
That's a novel. It's a comic novel. He's a great prose writer, great writer of character. He wasn't so good at plots.
Okay.
And so, you don't notice that in short stories, but over 300 pages, you're kind of like, come on.
Yeah, wrap
come on,
this DSP, up.
Let's get to happened. It. Yeah, let's get to it.
But, yeah.
But he's very funny. He's a great prose writer. Like, Amos really likes him. Like, really good prose writers think he's great. Like, Martin Amos, Salman Rushdie, Eudora Welty said he was the best prose writer in English. So that was, totally forgotten. I love getting people like that who are great, but no one knows, because then you can steal from them and no one knows.
Exactly, yeah. Somebody once said that, it's like, if you're reading normal fiction, like, you're not going to write interesting fiction. You've got to read some stuff that's hidden, or you've got to find stuff that's been forgotten and kind of bring it back in a new way.
Well, the writer Jennifer Vanderbeest has a really funny story about that. I don't remember. She didn't remember what the name of the book was, but she said once, she calls it the ice dildo effect. She said she read this pretty prim historical novel where in one chapter, the female protagonist went to her freezer and pulled out an ice dildo. And she said, that just blew her mind, Jennifer. She was like, that's what I want to do with my books. Like, you're never going to see that coming. So, like, she's like, I always want to put an ice dildo in my books in some way. Not specifically an ice dildo.
Yes.
Yeah. Don't cancel me. Cancel her for that. Her thing, Jennifer Vanderbeest at JenniferVanderbeest.com.
Yeah.
She's a good writer. I feel like she's not talked about enough, Jennifer. She's a good writer.
We'll have to read her too then, V.S. Pritchett and Jennifer. Yeah. But it seems like, you know.
Well, who are some people you love?
It's tough. Me? Well, there's this guy, Bud Smith, that I think the world of as a writer.
You mentioned him. I don't know.
His name. So I read a lot of his short stuff. I've got this right here, Double Bird right there. I gave it to Jamie Walters, actually.
Oh, really?
Out, but Yeah, it's the kind of like, I guess the closest thing you could compare him to is like Edgar Carret or maybe like Saunders or something, but he's just
so funny.
Funny but beautiful and just, you know, mostly joyous, you know, not a lot of darkness in Bud, so it's it's uplifting.
Edgar is a good writer. Saunders is a great writer too, but I feel like everyone knows Saunders. Edgar Carret, another one, is not. I mean, he's hugely successful worldwide, but maybe because he's Israeli, he's not as well known here as he might be.
Yeah.
He's a great writer and a sweet, sweet person. Like, I don't know him that well. He's a good friend with a friend of mine.
Mm.
And he just was very generous to me once about something. So I think he's really.
You know, I would say probably one of my favorite is Robert Walzer. I don't know if you read a lot of Walzer.
No, but I have read some.
Yeah.
Very short.
Very short, you know, not quite like fragmentary or like micro fiction, but. He's a really, really wonderful story writer.
From like the mid-century.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So different, because you write really funny stuff. He's not funny at all, right?
Yeah, you know what's funny is like, people always are telling me about Dennis Johnson and stuff, and
yeah, yeah.
Who I've never read, you know, but I
don't. Do you almost, like him, or you never?
I only read the one story, Emergency, because everyone kept telling me that my stuff reminded them of Emergency, but it's almost one of those things where like, I'm scared to now, because if I just realized that.
Yeah, Emergency's not even his best one.
Mm.
I shouldn't say this, because he just died. I think he's maybe slightly overrated. Like him a lot.
Well, it's like the MFA student duo is Saunders and Dennis Johnson, and they're always...
Yeah, and that book, especially when I was in grad school, that book was huge.
Yeah.
Like, everyone was just writing about it, like him. It actually shows the importance of going maybe against trends, because I, as I mentioned, it was the late 90s when I was in grad school, and everyone was writing... Dennis Johnson stuff, and very autobiographical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first book was about conjoined Asian
friends. I wanted to ask you about Chang and Eng, because it's such an interesting place to start.
Well, no one was doing anything like that.
So yeah.
I was like, I'm gonna do something different. And people in the workshop really violently rejected it. Like, in a way that I would have given up. That's what I owe Doctor for. Because the class tore it apart. Like, except for one person in the class and the teacher. The one person in the class is now published. It's Hannah Tinty.
Is that, I was going to say, yeah, she knows.
She knows. She's great. And Doctor. So, but if it wasn't for Doctor taking me aside after class and saying, yeah, you should keep going. Because people are like, you're not going to be able to pull this off. Like, what are you doing? This is so far from your experience. You're not nailing the tone. Like, how are you going to do a book that's so different from you? Like, what's the research going to be?
And this is just because they're so, at the time they were so... honed in on like auto fiction, autobiographical sort of like.
Uh-huh. And also it was ambitious in a way that I think they thought I couldn't pull off. And it was bad. Like the stuff I handed into grad school is not good. You know, I looked at it recently because I teach at NYU where I went. And in some deep dark vault there, they have every thesis that ever
existed. That's kind of scary.
And so a student of mine found it and was like, hey, I found your thesis. And I looked at it, and it was educational. I actually think I might, next time I teach a craft class, I might just show the first page of that and the first page of the book and be like, not that the book is so good, but you'll see how far you can come. And like, a first draft is not a final draft because it's pretty bad. But Doctor saw something there. I think he maybe appreciated that I was trying for it. But it's funny, I almost didn't get the job. So I went to NYU, sold my book, and then taught at Columbia. And then the job at NYU came up, and I was up for it. And I almost didn't get it because of Doctor O. It was something I had done in grad school. He was like, I don't know about that guy.
What did you do?
But then he was like, he was always very generous about my book. Like, he wrote about how much he liked Chang and Eng, and that meant a lot to me. Just because he's a great writer, but also he's a historical novelist.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's a huge shot. So when he publicly said he liked my book, that was great for me. But then when I was up for the job, he was like, I don't know. Because, so when I was in grad school, and you know, if she's listening, I apologize for telling the story, but I dated a woman who was in the program.
Okay.
Who had chronic fatigue syndrome. I also, it's weird how we call it the program. It's like a cult.
It sounds like the CIA.
Yeah. I'm in the program. Like, what? Oh, I'm a writing grad school. Yeah. It's not a cult. Yeah. The CIA. It's like not as cool as that. But anyway, so I was, you know, dating this woman in the program. And she was very sick at a certain point, and she didn't want to fail the class. So there was a giant craft class, and Doctor's craft class was, it was different back then. It was only one craft class, I think. So it was like 40 students, mm-hmm. and he was sort of checked out as a teacher by that point, I felt like, because he was teaching, he was putting a play on Broadway, and so I felt like he didn't even know anyone's name in the class. So she was like, I can't make it to class, but it's going to fuck my grade up. And I was like, I will sign you in. Just don't come to class and I'll sign you in. Because we had it to sign in.
And he's just, you're just hoping he's not going to
notice. But that's how, in person, like, there's no signing in now in grad school, right?
Yeah.
And if you're not there, I'm going to know.
Yeah, you wait for us to come in. And
Like, where's John? but so I signed her in. I didn't think he'd notice. And then in the class, he's like, Dan, can you come up? I want to ask you a question. And I was like, oh, he's going to compliment me on my comment about, Heinrich von Kleist or whatever. And he's like, I asked him, yeah, what you're saying about Kleist is interesting. And he's like, yeah, but why'd you send your girlfriend in? And I was like, oh, man, she's not here. You got to come to office hours. We'll deal with it. And I was close to being expelled.
Really? Just for that?
And then I told him the story. He's like, well, if you did it for love, I'll let it go.
They could expel you for that? Jeez.
So he was cool about it. He's like, yeah, he did it for love. I admire that. Yeah. I thought, okay, I'm in good with him. But then, 10 years later, I'm up for the job. And he was like, well, Darren's just signed a student in. I don't know. But then he did back me. Because he was a big supporter of my work.
Mm. Yeah.
And then...
he did the right thing in the end.
He did the right thing. Yeah, I think so.
Definitely. What was he like as a person and a teacher, like just being in the room with him? I mean, he is kind of larger than life, at least
to me. Sweet, sweet, sweet guy. Like, mm-hmm. one of the kindest, sweetest guys. I had him very late in his career, and I think he was, like I said, I don't know how engaged he was as a teacher at that time. But I shouldn't say that, because, he was very kind to me specifically in that, he saved me from... He saved me from being expelled. He saved me from throwing out my novel, which I was going to do. Mm-hmm. I left that class saying, I guess this is not what I'm going to work on.
Demoralizing, just the feedback?
If there's 12 people in the class and 11 of the students are like, get rid of this.
Yeah.
Like,
I know. That's a lot of pressure to just get rid of it.
And usually they don't say get rid of it. People are usually like, yeah, this is good, but everyone's like, no, you're not going to be able to pull this off. But yeah, so, and the third thing he did, which is a great piece of advice, which I think I should share, because it's good for everyone listening, if there are writers listening. So I was dating that woman, and she was getting published. And I had an agent at the time, because I sort of pretended I had an agent, because I had a friend who was 24, and I was 24, and he was like, I want to be an agent. And I was like, I want to be a writer. So all of a sudden, I had an agent who was answering phones for the Writer's House literary agency. So I did technically have an agent, but I was, his first client.
Yeah.
Whatever. He was also writing on the side, so he got published. So, coincidentally, in consecutive issues of the Paris Review, was my girlfriend and my agent. And I hadn't been published nowhere. So I was like, I went to office hours with Doctorow, and I said, I really have to get published. I want to get this book. So, I was working on Chang and Ang. I had like 5 pages of it. I was like, I got to get this book done by the end of next year. I want to get published, by the time 28 or whatever the fuck it was. And he was like, and he said, why? I said, I know everyone around me is getting published. He said, that's not a good enough reason. He said, when you're a young writer, you put all this pressure on yourself. I have to get published by X. I have to get published before everyone in my class, or I have to get published by the time I'm 30 or 35. Or I have to only work on this book for 2 years or 3 years, whatever. And he said, it's not a race. And it's more important that you take your time and make it perfect, because you don't want to give agents reasons to reject you. So if you have a book that's 90% there's 10% of things in that book that people can reject. So why hamstring yourself in that way? And no one's going to remember when you're 60. Like, oh,
it's a good book, but he was 33.
Yeah, exactly. Martin Amis was a great writer, or, Laura Moore, a great writer, but she didn't publish that book. That book took her 6 extra months. Like, no one knows that,
Right.
And he said he was the last of his writer friends to get published, and the only one still in print. So. And it's funny, I told that story forever, and I just didn't look it up. And I think he lied just to make me feel better, because someone's writing his biography, and his biographer called me because, you know, there aren't that many students of his who have published. So he interviewed me and Hannah Tinti from that period.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what is it like as a teacher? And I told that story. And he said, you know, Doctor got published at 26, right?
Oh, was it his first book?
I guess so. Because he was like, yeah, I wasn't published. I don't even know, 40, whatever. So I was like, okay, great. But that was just him being nice. I think that was...
Yeah, that is... I mean, he sounds like a great person.
The funny thing is, like, that was before Google. So I was like, okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I think that's another reason people thought that I shouldn't write Chang and Eng. Because it was much harder to do research back then, too. Like, when doctors said don't do research,
yeah,
he was like, you know, don't spend hours in the library.
Yeah, instead of writing.
Yeah, because I started writing that book before Google, and by the time I was done, Google was there. And it was a
interesting
big difference.
Interesting,
you know?
Yeah. So what were you, just like at NYU's library, just, you know, researching the twins?
Yeah.
Just
I found one used book about them, one out-of-print biography. And actually it was helpful because it was so boring. That's the difference between biography and fiction. Like, their story's so interesting. If you can't make that interesting, then it shows that you have to invent.
Right.
So I feel like if you do a good job, so if I did a good job with Chang and Eng, I feel like my book would have given a better picture of who they are, even though it's made up. Because you've got no sense of what it was like to be a conjoined twin.
It's just a series of facts.
Series of facts. Like, they came to New York in 1823, and they had 21 kids, and they were huge celebrities, and that's it. And all that stuff is interesting as a list of facts, but it doesn't tell you what it's like to be famous in 1830. It doesn't tell you what it's like to have 21 kids or to have sex with someone when your brother is attached to you, right? Like, they were married to sisters. How'd that
That's
work?
That's insane.
They had 21 kids between them. Like, they would switch off rooms, and they're each of their wives in a bedroom, and they'd switch off in the room. Like, you know, the other brother has to, like, be there while his brother's having sex with his wife.
And an excessive amount of times.
Yeah, and exactly a lot of times. Like, and the wife has to, in 1852, this is like a very prudish time, she has to have sex with her brother-in-law watching. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the book didn't get into that, so I was like, that's what I want to write about.
Yeah.
People are going to listen to this and think I'm a pervert. There's only two sex scenes I've ever written in my life. You know, it's six.
I mean, that one needs to be written. That one was required to come out.
Well, so you asked why I chose that.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like, what? Why did you start with the conjoined twins?
Because I felt like, okay, I didn't know how to write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like, well, Martin Amis says the thing, he talks about talent books, where, you know, books with not much story, you depend totally on talent. And I thought, well, I'm going to go the other way.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't sure about my talent, so I thought, what's an interesting story? And I heard about this story, and I thought, you know, everything they do is interesting. Like, how do they go to the bathroom? How do they eat dinner? How do they walk across the room? So in a way, it was like cheating for a novelist. You know, if you're writing your own story, how you walk across the room, how you eat dinner, that's the stuff you skip.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone's interested. Like, how do they have sex? How did they do that?
So like, all the mundane parts of life are filled with tension.
So I just thought, well, that gives me a chance to learn how to write a novel by writing about something I know is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was, I was homesick from work because I had a job when I was at NYU. And I turned on Oprah Winfrey, don't ask me why, and she had these conjoined twin girls on who were 8 years old. They had one body and two heads. And at the same time, they said, we're a big girl now. That's an incredible sentence. First of all, they said it together as if they shared a thought, which is weird because they didn't share a brain, obviously. And I thought, well, you could do some interesting things thematically as a novelist with that. Because I had just read Orlando by Virginia Woolf, where she talks about gender being fluid and how, according to her in that book, we're all different genders at different times. So that's the message of that book, I think, that, you know, sometimes we're more masculine, sometimes more feminine. Within each of us, there's a man and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, you know, there's something about conjoined twins where you could examine the idea that we're all different people at different times. I feel like I'm a different person when I'm teaching than I am with my kids, than I am with my wife, than I am with my high school friends. And so the fact that she said they said we're a big girl now means that there are two people and one person at the same time. So you could examine the self and how we're all different people and one person. So I thought that was thematically interesting. So I thought, well, I'll write a short story, or maybe I'll even write a novel about conjoined twins. And then the first day of research, I found out the story. I was going to make up twins, you know, in 1998 or whatever.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
Right, you know. And then, and I wrote, and I saw the story of Chang and Ang, and I thought, oh man, well, this story's so great just as a story, you know. Two brothers born in Thailand. They escaped. The king wanted them dead because he thought they were bad omens, so they escaped from the king, came to America, became huge celebrities, married sisters, had 21 kids, got caught up in the Civil War.
That life writes itself, essentially.
Yeah, and the Civil War is such a cool backdrop because, you know, it's like brother, the whole cliche of the Civil War is brother fighting brother. The country wants to split apart and can't, and they want to split apart and they can't, and they're fighting. So I just thought, well, that's a great book.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. First of all, I never would have thought about that, you know, just reading the synopsis or whatever, but that is such an interesting, especially when you bring the Civil War in, like, thematically, that story's representing itself on a larger scale.
Yeah, I was like, this is a perfect novel, and no one's done it.
Yeah.
And then I read that, so I start writing it, and then I read that Chang and that Nabokov had written a novel about conjoined twins that his wife, Vera, made him stop. She's like, no one must. So that sort of freaked me out. Well, I was like, I was of two minds. Yeah. Following the theme.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, if Nabokov thought it was a good idea for a story, then it's probably a good idea for a story. But then I thought, well, if his wife talked to him in the story, maybe it's... Because she thought it was tawdry. But I felt like, you know, it's really interesting. And, you know, Nabokov would have done a great job because he also was interested in doubles and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So. But it was a stroke of luck for me because I think, you know, I did learn how to write a novel writing that book. And I think the first drafts were probably bad, but it was enough of a story to keep me going because I was interested. But also just people were interested in it. And it was so different from what people were doing at the time. It's so much not a first novel.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that I sort of moved back. But then my fourth book was my memoir, which I feel like that would have been most people's first book.
At the time that you were writing Chang and Ang?
Yeah. Or just ever. Yeah.
Especially now. I mean, memoirs are still all the rage.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I was really lucky with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you get lucky sometimes, too, because I sold that book for very little money. And because I had that agent who was 24.
He's like,
I was his only client. And so, you know. He didn't do a good job.
Picking up phones, he's writing at his desk and trying to...
After he quit because he became a writer, a very successful guy, too. But and then I got a real agent. After that, my agent was like, what's the deal with that agent? This is a terrible contract. Like, none of this makes sense. But so I got really lucky. I sold it for no money, and the publisher wasn't very happy with it. I mean, they were like, yeah, whatever. We're not going to send it in a book tour or anything. Mm-hmm. And then they sent it around to get blurbed, and they sent it to Joyce Carol Oates, who I didn't know and who didn't teach NYU at the time. And she loved the book and gave it an amazing blurb and talked it up somewhere. And that got the publisher totally excited by it. But then she, I guess, in an interview talked about, is this exciting new book coming out or something? And then she blurbed it. So the publisher was like, oh, maybe we should give this a second look. And then so they added a book tour, and the book did really well. I was very lucky, you know, knock on wood. So... I owe a lot to Joyce Carol Oates, I think, in that way. I used to curse my luck because I'd be like, I had friends with an iPad agent, and I was like, I had a shitty agent, and I sold it to a small publisher. It didn't. But then, you know, you got to remember you're lucky, too. It's all, you know, strikes and gutters, Lebowski says.
Yeah. You know, my dad just read Half a Life, and I'm going to read it soon.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but that's clearly a memoir, and it's traumatic kind of experience for you.
But did he like it?
Loved it. Yeah. I mean, I wish I could have him here. He was a huge fan.
I'd like to have him here, too.
Yeah. We talked about it quite a bit, but, you know, something about, I guess, how long were you carrying around Half a Life with you, like, through your fiction career? Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's an interesting thing. So I'll tell the story of what it's about. So when I was in high school, it's funny, I guess I'm still anxious about it because as soon as I started talking about it, my leg was bouncing up and down here. But this is a visual podcast, right? Like, you can see that.
No. Yeah, you're good. They can hear it, though.
Okay, good.
They'll hear the wood rattling.
There's sound effects, sorry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I when I was in high school, I was driving with some friends, and a girl swerved her bicycle in front of my car, and I hit her, and she died. And even though this happened three or four towns over from where I lived, and it was really far from my house, she went to my high school. It was just coincidental. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know at the time she was committing suicide using my car. So I had tons of guilt about accident. And her parents, I went to the funeral. It was still the hardest thing I ever had to do, going to the funeral. And her parents at the funeral said to me, you know, we know it wasn't your fault. Because the police and five cars worth of eyewitnesses were all like, you know, it wasn't his fault. We know it wasn't his fault, and we'll never blame you. But you have to do whatever you're going to do in life twice as well. You have to be twice as successful, twice as happy. It's a lot of that shit.
It's a lot of pressure
to put on a 17-year-old kid. Yeah. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. And then 6 months later, they sued me for millions of dollars after promising me, like, we know it wasn't your fault. And I mean, I don't blame them. They were in a rough spot, and they had some really scumbag lawyer try to manipulate them.
Yeah, but my dad pointed that he's like, I don't think he's a big fan of lawyers. He said, well,
not lawyers. Just whenever there's an accident, there's a whole actuarial calculation. And if your insurance company thinks, if there's a death and your insurance company thinks you're not to blame, they have a minimal settlement they'll offer. So they automatically offer $20,000, which is the lowest they could offer. And that means that they think you're not at fault. Mm-hmm. So that's what they offer, $20,000. And then when they were offered money, they said, well, maybe we should contact the lawyer. So the lawyer said, $20,000, that's an insult. You should get $6 million. And then for years, the case dragged on, you know, 6-7 years. And then right at the end, right before it went to trial, their lawyer said to them, take the $20,000, you're not going to get more. He's not at fault.
Oh, my God.
So
he just billed them for seven years
and dragged them and me through this thing for years, and then took 30%. So not only did they only get $20,000, maybe it's even $15,000, some crazy low number. They lost 30% of that to this lawyer. It was a terrible thing.
Awful.
But so the funny thing is, I buried this so deep in myself that when people were writing autobiographical fiction, I would always say, and mean it, well, I have nothing in my life to write about. Like, I have a pretty boring life. I just grew up in the suburbs of Long Island. Nothing happened to me, so there's no book there anyway. Not even thinking I could write about it. It was so painful, mm-hmm. I didn't even think that it would be a book, that I could write about it.
It was just this thing you were trying to basically forget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it was only when I was 36, so I was exactly double my life when it happened. That's what I call half a life. Mm-hmm. So I lived exactly as long with the accident as I had before, and then And my wife was pregnant, so all this stuff was happening, and I felt like, I guess I should try to deal with this thing that I buried. And it really fucked me up. Like, I had stomach issues, my hair was gray when I was in my late 20s. I think it really fucked me up. So writing about it was a big help.
And how did that process start? Did you, like, were you in therapy, or were you just like, how was...
I wasn't in therapy for it. I had a bad therapist, too, which I write about in the book. Mm-hmm. No, I just, you know, as a writer, I'm sure this is how it is for you too, I just feel like, in order to figure out what I feel about things, I'll just write it down. And then, you know, John Updike said a writer's main responsibility is to be published, so I had a couple pages. I was like, I guess I should try to see what I have here. And then I just thought, okay, I'll write this book. It'll be a small thing. I did it with McSweeney. I was going to do it with my regular publisher, which is Penguin Random House. But I thought it might be really small because I just want to write about the accident. And so it's going to be like 30 or 40 pages. And my publisher said, we'll publish it, but it can't be 30 or 40 pages. And I said, well, what if that's all there is? And someone at the publisher was like, well, just, you know, pad it out with, like, you know, childhood memories or crap like that. And that's what they said. And I was like,
it's kind of cold.
I was like, I can't really tell the story about this dead girl.
Yeah.
And pad it out with crap and feel good about it. So I was just going to not do it because I felt like I have to be respectful to what happened. And if the story is only going to be 30 pages, that's what it has to be, so I just won't do it. But then Dave Eggers, who at that point was running McSweeney's, said, well, fuck, I'll publish it at 30 pages. I don't care. sounds like a good book. So I said, all right, I'll do a 30-page book. And then it ended up being 150 pages. Oh, wow. I could have done it with my regular publisher anyway, but I think it was only because I had the freedom to make it small that I felt free enough to then write the book I wanted to write and not worry about commercial stuff. So I thought it was going to be very small because I thought, well, it'll appeal to people in the accident community, but it wasn't, a general story. But actually, it ended up being my most commercially successful book, I think, because I realized that there are a lot of people out there who feel guilty about stuff that they're not culpable for. So there are a lot of people who feel bad about things that they didn't do wrong, but they still feel bad about it. So I actually wanted to publish a book of all the emails I got. I couldn't do it because it was legal issues were too complicated, but I got probably over 1,000 emails from people just sharing their stories, and some of them are so amazing. Like someone, who felt guilty because she was a twin and her brother was born with severe brain damage because of the delivery was screwed up by the doctor. Like, there's no reason for her to feel guilty. She was twin the baby at the time. Or someone who felt guilty because her father died and she laughed at the funeral. She was carrying that around for 30 years, never told anyone. All this stuff. And I was just like, wow, that would be a great book. But I realized that that's why the book has resonated with people, I think, because there's something about, a lot of us carry around stuff that we feel guilty about, even if we shouldn't. And I knew intellectually it wasn't my fault.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I was so tortured by it that I would go to the library at college and I would study, like, reaction time and miles per hour. And I would be like, okay, if I'm going 45 miles an hour and she's going 20 and she cuts in front of me at 20 feet, I realized there's not even a physical way I could have avoided her. Mm-hmm.
Why were you even,
As if that mattered. Like, even if best driver ever could have avoided her, why does that matter? But for me, it really mattered. Mm-hmm. So, like, there was nothing I could have done, no matter what.
Yeah.
So even knowing that. But there's a funny thing. So when I wrote the book, I actually had to go back and do research about the accident. I'd known that it was written about in the local newspaper, but I'd forgotten. And so I went back and found the article. And it was like a gift from the past. The police officer interviewed by the reporter said, he's going to beat himself up for this forever, but he shouldn't because it wasn't his fault. So to read that at 36, that was a powerful moment for me. I was lucky that happened before Google because that was 1989, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was in high school. And then I went off to college the next year, and no one knew. Mm-hmm. I would have carried that around with me forever.
Mm-hmm.
And, people don't look into nuance, and so if you're like, oh, you're the guy who killed that girl,
Someone will just say that to you, probably.
People say that to me anyway. The girl I was supposed to go to the prom with wouldn't go with me because she didn't go to my high school, but she read it in the newspaper. I had this sort of girlfriend from another town, and she's like, oh, I saw you in the paper. I can't go to the prom with you anymore. I was like, oh, thanks a lot for the support. And it's right in the paper. It was like, it wasn't his fault.
Yeah. She probably just read the headline.
And then, when the book came out, the book's 10 years old now. It's kind of funny. The Village Voice was still around. And the Village Voice did this story on me. It was cool because it was like the cover story of the Village Voice, which was like a big, exciting thing. It wasn't about my book. It was about, there's this group of people who went after established writers because they were like, it's unfair that these people have published them or not. So I was one of the people I went after. So I was on the cover of the Village Voice and very excited about that. And then next issue, there was the first letter in the letters to the editor was, how could you put a murderer on the cover? And I was like, that kind of ruined that, career milestone for me,
That's just, who wrote that? It wasn't like another writer or something.
It was just some random person, but, because I talked in the article, they're like, what are you working on next? And I told about my book that I was working on called Half a Life that was going to come out, 2009 or whatever, 2010. I guess this was probably 2008 when this came out. The article, and it hurts.
Did you go back and talk to old classmates or the family or anything when you were doing the writing?
Well, I reached out to the family. They didn't respond. Okay. I heard from a lot of her friends afterwards. That's how I felt. She left a note that was sort of indicated she was committing suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And I read about that in the book. But then after the book came out, I heard from a lot of her friends who said, oh, no, she was definitely committing suicide. Like, she was talking about death all week, talking about committing suicide all week.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reason for her to swerve into traffic.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the left lane. There was a right lane and then the shoulder. So she swerved across two lanes of traffic into my car. So, I mean, I'll never know for sure, I guess. Yeah. But, so I heard from a lot of her friends. But it's funny how memory works, too, because I remember people being mean to me and cold to me. And I talked to this football player who was like, you remember when the football team brought your homework? Because I didn't go to – it was traumatic, so I didn't go into school for the week after.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tough then to go back to school because everyone's like, there's the kid who killed that girl, whatever. But this football team, I guess, brought my homework home for me and like was like, you're not in school. We want to show you we support you. We're bringing you your homework. Like a very kind gesture.
Yeah.
I totally forgot. didn't appreciate it at all, I guess. I don't know.
Doesn't speak
well of me.
There has to be some sort of psychological principle there, but I think that, yep, we just don't. Yeah. But,
no, but I was too, I mean, you know, I'm a pretty sensitive person, and I wonder how much that is the accident, too. Like, I think it made me more introspective and more, changed me a lot, but... A friend of mine in the car who was a passenger said to me recently, he was driving. I said, why? And he said, I feel like I could have handled it better. You beat yourself up so much. Like, I really beat myself up forever.
Yeah.
Like, if there's a critique of the book that I get a lot, it's that I'm too hard on myself.
Mm.
But I think that's good for a memoir. I think too many memoirs are too easy on the memoirist, where that's what you can just feel the writer forgiving himself or herself in each paragraph. And, you know, I think you want to go too far in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no reason. Too many people write memoir to settle scores and make themselves look good. And I think you have to really fight that impulse. And so going too far in the other direction, I think, is the move.
Do you have, like, a... What do you think about memoir in general? Do you read them? Do you have a favorite memoirist? Are you familiar at all with, like, this whole auto-fiction debacle?
Yeah. Debacle?
Because Joyce Carol Oates made that tweet. Wan little husks of
well, yeah, so interesting.
Auto fiction.
So, you mentioned Joyce. She said that. My last book was nominated for the Joyce Carol Oates Prize. And I was up against Jenny Offill. Yeah, she's a very good writer. And her new one, Weather. And so her book... my book, we're a finalist with a couple other books, and her book is a very small autofiction book. And the week that Joyce was reading her book, Joyce tweeted that. And so Jenny emailed me and said, I guess I'm not winning the award. And so...
So that's who it was about. You know, potentially.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Because I think that, you know, I think a panel names the finalist and then Joyce weighs in. And so that was her way of saying...
Mm-hmm.
Jenny's not going to win.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's like...
I like all different kinds of books. I think Jenny's a great writer. Mm-hmm. I love the first Knausgård chapter.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I didn't love the whole book, but I thought the opening of that book...
Is that in the morgue or whatever? Yeah. Right? Yeah. I like him quite a bit. And
And Rachel Cusk is obviously a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Is it on
Tao Lin?
Tao Lin.
I can't write like that. But I think that... Like, Tao Lin, wow. I don't know how he's pulling this off.
Yeah.
Because I felt like this should be much more boring than it is, because nothing happens, and he describes everything and kind of flat prose, and yet I think it worked as a book, so I found that really interesting. I'm always amazed by people who can pull off stuff that I... have no idea.
How. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I certainly don't know how they do it either.
There's a lot of, you know, having talked about teaching craft for many years now, I feel like there are most books, even if I feel like I can do it, I can figure out how they work. Some writers I just can't. Like, I have no idea how, I don't know how Lydia Davis.
Oh, right.
So Lydia Davis, I don't know how she pulls it off. Like, I think she's a great writer. Some of her stuff is moving, and some of it isn't, and I never know why. Like, I never know why this piece doesn't work, and this one does, for me. And I think that that's just pure talent, right? Like, you can't find the craft in it. I don't know. I think, but I do feel like I'm drawn to writers with great craft, like Nabokov or Tolstoy, mm-hmm. or, you know, Lori Moore, I mentioned a lot. She's great, I think.
Well, something that's pretty amazing, too, about your writing is, like, and maybe you get it from E.L. Doctorow. I don't know how influenced you are in your career by him being your teacher, but it's, like, the ability to take on, like, celebrities as narrators.
Yeah, I don't know.
Which would scare the hell out of me. But it does feel like something maybe, like, Tolstoy would do. But it's like, having the confidence, I guess, to get in their perspective and just run with it.
The funny thing is, I didn't want to be... Once I started writing historical fiction, and I don't write historical fiction exclusively, of course, mm-hmm. but once I wrote my first book, I didn't want to read Doctor because I felt like it would be too I'd be too influenced. I actually didn't read him until after I finished the book. But yeah, I guess maybe his idea, he would say, go for it. So maybe that's where it comes from. But to me, you know, I read this thing by Updike once where he said, I think he was talking about full dress fiction, I think he called it, where it's like, he said something like, after Melville, American fiction split into two camps, where one is like giant stories taking on big issues that are entertaining also, and literary small novels that show great interiority. And he said, you know, Melville had both of those things, but then they went, like, there's Dreiser and then there's James. And there. So I thought, well, I want to try to do both. Mm-hmm. You know? So I felt like with this last book, I wanted to write, you know, a really literary book that had good prose and was psychologically acute, but also had a big story that was fun.
Yeah.
Like, you could, why not try to do that? There was an executive, once I was, there was some literary festival, I can't remember what it was. There's something in Florida. It was thrown by Barnes & Noble. So I went down to Florida for it and, you know, hung out with these Barnes & Noble executives. The writers were with the executives. And this Barnes & Noble executive was like, the difference between literary fiction, she was trying to compliment literary fiction, but she was saying, the difference between literary fiction and pop fiction is literary fiction, you have to read slowly. You know, there's no page turning. And I was like, well, fuck that. You know, I want to do both.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, why not try to do both? Mm-hmm. And Doctorow, at his best, I think, did that. There's a book, Billy Bathgate.
Oh, I never read that one.
That's maybe my favorite of his, because it's really fun. It's about a gangster. And every scene seems like the climax. Every scene seems like the climax of an adventure book.
So it's
like, he starts with a scene that would be the climax of most literary novels, and it keeps going from there. Every scene is this crazy, exciting thing. I was like, that's exciting to me. There's a quote from Alan Moore. I think I got this from David Lipsky, too. He talks about, Alan Moore is a comic book writer, and so Alan Moore said something like, I loved the comics I read as kids. I remember them as being all action scenes. And so I wrote my first comic. I wanted it to be like the best comics I read when I was a kid, which are all climactic action scenes. And then I went back and read those comics, and they weren't that. But that's how I remember them, so I wanted to write a comic that was like my memory of my favorites, not my favorites. And in so doing, he might have invented a new kind of comic, which is all high points, mm-hmm. you know? I think if you can go, I had a professor once who said, go from strength to strength. And so, like, if you can write a book that's all high points, then, you know, you're doing something
just right. Keep escalating, no matter where you
and
start.
It doesn't have to be a plot thing. Like, there are not a lot of books that are high points that have no plot, like Beckett, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But for him, high points are great prose or great jokes or great whatever. Mm-hmm. So, like, I think so many of us when we write, we're like, I know first 5 pages are great, and then it's pretty good, then page 20 is awesome,
mm-hmm.
and page 50 is awesome. So why not just cut from 1 to 20 to 50, and then you have a...
Cause as long as it makes sense, like, why not, you know?
I feel like everyone's too committed to connective tissue. Like, I don't know anyone who reads a book where they would say, every scene is awesome, but the connective tissue is not great. Like, you're not going to care.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
Do you think it's like an obsession just with, like, interiority, where we want to just, like, stay, you know, we want to, like, stay with a character as close as... We want to have, like, the psychological insights and observation.
I don't know if it's that as much as just, like, it's hard to write high points. You know, I mentioned V.S. Pritchett and Lori Moore. They're both short story writers, primarily. They've written novels, but mostly they're famous for their short story work, and they would write 60 pages for a 10-page story.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just do the high points. And that's what I think takes a long time, but that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
So Stuart Dybeck does that. If you ever read him, his stories are crazy. He writes just short stories, but even the short stories have these weird juxtapositions where it's like one awesome scene and then another awesome scene that doesn't really make sense. But part of the joy is just seeing these weird things jammed together. And there's a pleasure in that too. I don't know if it's interiority, because sometimes high points can be interiority.
Yeah.
Interiority can be high points of their own. Like, you know, in Ulysses, for example.
That's true. We're doing a Ulysses book club.
No way.
Our class. With people in my class, yeah.
In our class?
Like, in the program.
The people I know?
Maybe some of them. Like, Liz Eyre and Evan's going to do it.
Who?
Evan Cerniglia.
Who's Liz Eyre?
Oh, Liz Eyre is another first-year student. I don't know if you had it.
But Evan, I know.
Yeah.
Evan I actually taught as an undergrad.
Oh, really? Yeah. I think you might have told me this. I don't know. Evan's great.
Good guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. But, yeah, it's, I mean, that's kind of refreshing to hear, because I'm reading a great thriller right now.
Which one?
It's called The Red Sparrow by Jason Matthews. Jason Matthews.
I'm writing a thriller. I'm really trying to test my theory now, because I'm writing a thriller. I want the prose to be great.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say about The Queen of Tuesday, is that there's tons going on, and it's funny, and I mean, the first three or four pages, you have like a physical assault of Lucille Ball, and you know, it's very quickly moving.
Yeah.
You're not like ruminating on a lot of stuff. You're not spending a lot of time like describing the streets of New York or Coney Island or whatever. It's not slow at all.
So there was all that stuff.
So editing maybe is a huge...
I think a lot of it is how much you can get away with. Like, I want it to be literary. Mm-hmm. I want it to be evocative. So I want you to be able to picture Coney Island and New York City. But I don't want to overdo it.
Yeah.
No one wants to read too much description.
Yeah, you talk about
like the best line of description. You don't need seven of them if you have one great one.
You know what I love too in the beach scene in the beginning is something about when they're wearing high heel. It reminds me, high heel, only a man would plan a
party.
A gala on a beach.
Yeah, so I wanted to examine misogyny a little bit.
Yeah.
If you're writing a book about a woman, you have to show that you understand what misogyny is.
Yeah, but that kind of line does so much too. I mean, it's giving you setting, it's giving you... you know, some subtext. It's giving you a little bit about their relationship, and I mean, it's. But you're not. It's like if I was going to write a historical novel. If I was going to write a novel like The Queen of Tuesday, I would spend so much time.
Yeah,
I guess flowering it up.
I think I did that more in my first book. I think, you know, I've written a bunch of books now, so I feel more confident in knowing what you can get away with. I think my first book had a lot more of that.
Yeah,
because I was writing about, you know, 1811 Siam, and I, you know, I overdid it.
Right, right.
With the research and everything.
Yeah, but I guess to the point of just, it can be both. It can be entertaining and the prose, and it can be literary. And
yeah,
and it's sometimes not like rare, but it's not as common as you would think either.
Well, Nabokov, I mentioned, he did that, especially in his earlier books before Lolita. He would take kind of thriller plots and make them literary books. Have you ever read like King, Queen, Knave or Laughter in the Dark? Laughter in the Dark is a pure soap opera where a woman and her boyfriend dupe a rich man and blind him so they can steal his money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's pure soap opera. But it's Nabokov, so, you know, the prose is so good and the insights are so good you don't care, but it's also a page turner.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really pushing that now because I'm writing like a sci-fi thriller.
Yeah.
I want to see, you know, Colson Whitehead did that with Zone One. And I actually, it's funny, I'm friends with Colson, and I just asked him about that because I'm working on this thriller and I asked him. And he said he felt like he over compensated. He felt like, I'm writing a zombie book, I have to tart it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So he feels like if he would do that book over, he'd have less. I'm a great literary writer and I'm doing this down market book, I have to prove it. So he felt like, he said, there are times when he can feel himself trying to prove that he's a great writer.
Okay.
More than his literary books, because he was self-conscious about writing a zombie book. And he feels like, the funny thing is there's more overwriting in that book than in Underground Railroad. I mean, I shouldn't speak for him, but that's what he said.
Yeah, yeah.
To me.
So is that's the challenge then? Is kind of like weighing the literary voice with the
Because you want, you know, that's what, you know, great movies will do. And so you want to be, I guess books don't do this as often. You want to be like The Godfather, the movie version. Because the book of The Godfather, it's kind of a potboiler. But the movie is a masterpiece. And it's because brilliant style is applied to this fun story, this run-of-the-mill story. And, you know, that's what Soderbergh does in his movies. Like, that's what I love. This is something I mentioned David Lipsky. He I think, brought this to my attention. This is what Soderbergh wants to do. He wants to be an art house movie maker who makes pop movies.
Mm.
So if you look at Ocean's 11, I think they're more like that now because of people like him, where they would, you know, I guess in the 90s, Hollywood got wise and was like, let's take some brilliant art house directors and give them pop movies to do. That's why superhero movies from the 80s are goofy, and superhero movies now are often good. Like, Ang Lee will do a Hulk movie. Or, you know, Ocean's 11, I think, is a brilliantly made film with great style, but it's also just a dumb heist movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of refreshing to see that, like, to hear that you're doing this as a project, and, you know, I would often define a lot of the stories that I read or the fiction that I read as mostly plotless. And
yeah, and I think it can be annoying sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, Gary Stringer was saying that. Then I started reading
Philip K. Dick and just trying to get totally plot-oriented. But
he's annoying, too, because I feel like I never like his stuff, even though it's brilliant plot-wise and concept-wise.
Yeah.
Because I find the prose so bad.
It's essentially like, yeah, he's essentially like
an amateur.
Yeah. I mean, his prose is not phenomenal.
Yeah, I shouldn't say that because he's kind of a genius, too. But you want to, I guess, yeah, if you could have, like, Laurie Moore's prose and Philip K. Dick's stories.
Yeah.
That's, so I'm reading a thriller now, which I got from Jerome at NYU, called Eye of the Needle. It's a really good thriller.
What's it about? Is it sci-fi thriller?
No, it's about World War II. It's a Nazi and spy in London.
Great.
I should say it's either Le Carre sometimes disappoints me, because I feel like it's sort of like the worst of both in a way. Like, I love, when Le Carre's good, he's great. Like, I love this spy came in from the cold. But Philip Roth had said that was The Perfect Spy or something. Was the best English novel of the last 50 years. I was like, oh, Philip Roth said it better be good. So I read it, and I felt like it was kind of boring and plotless in the beginning. And the prose wasn't good enough to justify that. So it was like, you're getting half a literary novel and half a spy novel, and that's the last thing you want.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly is a middle ground, and it's you know, I think that you'll probably find it, but it's like, at risk of sounding cliche, it's almost like, I don't know, we all had to grow up like reading Shakespeare.
Right.
And he was firing on all cylinders.
Shakespeare's a great example. It's lost now. Like, he didn't even write his own stories. He would take a great story and steal it.
Exactly, yeah. What you're talking about with The Godfather, or, you know, finding some boring boring biography written several centuries ago.
Yeah. And there are many people who wrote Romeo and Juliet, and only one is
great. Yeah.
So that's the lesson I got. One lesson I got from Neil Doctor's class. So he assigned this book from 1800s, 1700s, called Michael Kuhlhaus. It's a German book by Kleist, I mentioned it before. It's a story of a serf who's wronged by the landowner, and he goes crazy and he starts a rebellion against unfairness, and it starts because they take his cow, his prize cow, and kill it, and he's a reasonable man, and they won't give him the money, and he keeps asking for it, and then he starts a surf rebellion, and anyway, so Doctorow, I'm glad he signed the book, because it was a very sly thing to do, because then when I read Ragtime, I realized he stole that plot.
Ah.
Exactly. So in Ragtime, the book was Michael Kuhlhaus. The surf was wronged by the rich. Michael, in Ragtime, there's a character, a ragtime piano player, a black man named Kuhlhaus Walker. And the corrupt police take his car and destroy it. And he very reasonably says, just give me the money for the car. And they won't. And he starts a rebellion and gets, underrepresented people from that area to rebel against the power structure.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same story. Like a decent, non-violent man wanting just justice but not getting it from the power structure, mm-hmm. and then having enough and causing a violent rebellion. Exact story.
It's cool that
beat for beat.
And it's so, cool that Doctorow would give away his secret slyly, you know? Yeah. But
that's a great lesson.
Yeah. Because
Doctors is better. And, or at least different enough to justify it. Like, it's not plagiarism, mm-hmm. I don't think. If there's only 36 stories, which is what they say.
Well, but how many times is that? Yeah, right, exactly. How many times is that story, you know, shown up in various forms? Right.
So I think you should allow yourself to be influenced in that way. And, so why not take a great plot and put style on it, you know? So that's what I'm trying to do anyway.
Cool.
But I think music is like that too, in a way where, you know, there's nothing worse. I admire literary fiction much more than genre fiction. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse than literary fiction when it's bad. Like a genre book will at least have some satisfaction. It's like pop music and jazz, I feel like. I love jazz, you know, and I'm a musician. I'm not good enough to be a jazz musician, really, but there's nothing worse than bad jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Like, bad pop is going to have something that makes you want to listen to it because it appeals to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Bad jazz is just going to be unlistenable. But but good pop is rarely as transcendent as good jazz, I think.
I like that comparison.
But, like, if you could mix it, like, I think that's what, in a way, James Brown, people like that did, where it's, like, brilliant jazz-influenced music, but also catchy and fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you pulled it off with The Queen of Tuesday, too. Did you steal, what plot did you steal with that?
None.
Right, exactly. Where'd you,
But it's not a really complicated plot. No, it's like a romance story.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not stealing a plot for this. I had a dream, and that's what this
came from a dream.
My last book, too. Queen of Tuesday came from a dream, too.
So all right, well, what happened there?
So I woke up in the morning, I was like, oh, here's my next book. I wrote it down. Went back to sleep and I was like, this is going to be great. And I woke up and I was like, what was that? And I just could barely make out my writing and it just said Lucille Ball and Papa Izzy. I was like, what the fuck is that? I had a dream, I guess, about my grandfather Lucille Ball.
What?
So I started doing research about her and I realized that I must have heard something because there's a chance they were at this party together thrown by Trump's dad.
Oh, you know, Trump, the name Trump shows up in the beginning of the book and...
That's a true thing. So Trump's father threw this party for real estate people and celebrities. Wow. My grandfather was there. And Lucille Ball was there.
Huh. Yeah, what do you think he would think if your grandfather read about this affair in your book?
I feel like, I show him pretty much warts and all, like he makes morally dubious decisions here.
Yeah.
He's not a good husband. He's not a good father, really. Especially a bad husband. Mm. In a way that, you know, I wanted to show that he's flawed. But he always wanted to be a writer and never could. And so I think he'd just be psyched to. I don't know. Like, we talked earlier in the talk, I think, about, unless the mic was not, how I'm going to go on CBS Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And I'm doing this other PBS TV show. I think, you know, because the book's about Lucille Ball, maybe it would help me get listening for it, whatever. So I'm going to be on CBS. So I got to show my grandfather's picture and talk about him.
Yeah.
And that's going to be, you know, for the millions of people. So mm-hmm. hopefully he would be psyched.
Yeah, no, I'm sure he would.
Some people are angry at me, though.
About the portrayal?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I understand why, but in what ways are they expressing their anger? They're just...
My aunt is like, you know, both my aunts, they say, that's not how grandma was, or, you know, I'm like, that's how I saw it, whatever. Like,
yeah.
Grandma wasn't shy, and, you know, like, why are you talking about an affair of our family? I don't know. Everyone's dead.
Yeah.
You know. And I got to talk about my grandfather in a way that he's talked about on the radio and TV and in newspapers. Like, I don't know. He lives on in, for a couple months in the way he never would have.
Yeah, absolutely. When, is it this Sunday?
No.
Oh.
I filmed it a while ago and it's not going to air. They, you know, because it's not a news story, they said it'll air sometime between now and October?
Okay.
Which sucks because the book's coming out. So I'd love it to air sooner. They just want it to air within a year of the anniversary of Lucille Ball's show. So her show came out in 1951. So anytime, basically between now and the end of 1951. Okay. Because it's the 70th anniversary of her show. So,
very excited for that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was nervous. I was really hungry, and I was in my house, and it was during COVID, so I don't know. Like, I've been on TV before. I'm not good at, like, I don't know. Luckily, no one mentioned any class. Oftentimes, someone will find a video of me. I was on.
They gave you too many drinks.
Oh, did I talk about that?
No, I found the video of you.
Yeah, so I was on the Late Late Show before what's his name was the host.
Yeah, I forget
the carpool karaoke guy.
I forget the guy who was the host when you went on.
It was I was on right before that. So I was on 10 years ago. It was Craig Ferguson.
Oh right.
Yeah, it was awesome. Like it's a dream come true. Yeah, yeah. Like I had dreams of being a comedian or whatever when I was a kid. So like to be on the CBS Late Late Show was fucking awesome, but I didn't do a good job.
Well, what makes you say that? It was a fun interview.
Well, that book was pretty serious. It was my third book, I guess. And it's about Munchausen by Proxy. It's a serious topic, and right before it went on, they're like, you have to be funny. So I downed a bunch of wine. And, you know, I was like, I didn't have any jokes prepared, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, it's funny, like, unions and TV, there's a guy whose job is just to refill the host's water. So for 5 days a week, for an hour, his job is just to fill a water cup. He probably makes a good living, you know?
Probably.
And so he's doing nothing. So he's standing around backstage, and he told me who he was, and he's like, are you nervous? And I was like, no, not that much. He said, you should be. In 30 seconds, you know, 2.1 million people are going to watch you. And you're going to have to be funny in front of a live audience and 2.1 million people.
You think, like, he says that to everyone?
I don't know, but that fucked me up, you know?
Yeah.
So, I didn't do a great job.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was great. Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, it's fun.
It's cool to see someone be, like, genuine on a talk show host. On a talk show. Late night show.
It's awesome for me. I get to dine out in that story forever. Like, you know, I heard from a lot of people who don't read books, you know, like, you realize how few people read books when you're on other media. Like, Half-Life was excerpted This American Life. I didn't realize how big that show was. You know, NPR.
Massive.
Oh, man. Like, so many more people contacted me from that show than anything I've ever done. And same thing with being on, you know, a national TV show. Like, people who never reach out to me. Like, yeah, I had like three, four books at that time. People were like, hey, I had no idea you were still alive or whatever, you know? And Coulson said that because Coulson Whitehead was just on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, I've seen him on TV.
A different level. Yeah. Like, well, he's the biggest, probably the biggest writer in America right now. He had won two Pulitzer Prizes and had number one bestseller. He told me, I just had dinner with him last week. That's why I'm bringing him up 2 weeks ago. He said, when he was in 60 Minutes, people reached out to him from his family. You were like, oh, I didn't know you were writing. Like, this is a guy
that's insane.
Who's won Pulitzer Prizes and then.
But if he was on a pharmaceutical commercial.
Yeah, yeah.
They would all call him.
But, you know, it just showed, like, me, whatever. But Coulson Whitehead, like, you can't get more successful than that. And still, people in his own family are like, oh, I didn't know you were writing.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm glad he made it. Is what he said. Someone said, "I'm glad it's working out for you." Like, oh, the two Pulitzers.
Yeah, post Pulitzer.
He had two Pulitzers in 4 years. Like, he won in 2016 and 2020 or 2019, whatever it was. Like, that kind of run that you haven't seen since, like, I don't know, Philip Roth in the '60s or something. Like, that's incredible. Yeah. And like his family. So it's a little humbling.
It's somewhat disheartening, but you know,
somewhat disheartening.
I mean, maybe it'll come back, but.
I don't know.
So
I feel like, I also feel like I got, those are the last gasp. Like, they're not having literary writers on the Late Late Show anymore.
No. Memoirists for sure. And celebrity memoir, obviously. But
that, I got in under the wire with that one.
Yeah.
That was
perfect timing. Yeah.
Because he was a pretty literary guy, Craig Ferguson, because he'd written some books. So the week I was on, he also had, must have been like, the non-sweeps week where they could sneak writers in. Because I was on the same week as Salman Rushdie.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, he had writers on, literary writers mm-hmm. on. That was fucking awesome. Yeah. That was fun.
And then CBS is just in your house, and it's probably still fun, but.
That was fun. I know. I'm not.
Yeah.
Poo-pooing that. That's going to be. And the publisher's really, like, you know, it's hard to get attention for literary novels.
Yeah, so right, the publisher's
very excited about that.
Yeah.
So.
Well,
hopefully it will air, really will air.
Yeah. I mean, I think it will, but.
The funny thing is, also, like, they come to your house and they totally remodeled it because they're like, oh, this doesn't look good. So they moved shit around and my wife was like, what are you doing? But then we left it because, like, oh, they know what they're doing. So my living room now looks totally different.
It's just, like, better?
It's better.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's exciting. I mean, the book deserves, you know, more attention or all. The book Thank deserves you. The attention that it's going to get on television and you know,
yeah,
that'll
I
be
appreciate
fun.
That. Yeah.
And, you mentioned, like, something I kind of want to ask, you know, just because you've been an author for so long and you've been successful at it, is you just keep mentioning all these people that you've met and gotten dinner with Colson Whitehead, and I was
am I name-dropping in a bad way?
Oh, no. No, I didn't mean to sound like that. No, it's just, like, that you've had a fruitful, like, a long, fruitful career in this, and you've been in New York, and you've been publishing for quite some time.
You get to know people.
And I was kind of wondering, like, you got a good story? Got some... You got any?
I was there when Colson Whitehead spit on Richard Ford. Do you know that story?
No, I don't.
So there was some. This is such a good story. Because Colson comes out on top. So there was some literary event, I can't remember what it was, a long time ago, like 2005. And I was there, and Colson was there, Richard Ford was there. I never met Richard Ford, still haven't met him. Just a bunch of writers were there. And. Colson had given Richard Ford's novel a bad review in the New York Times. And so Richard Ford went up to him and said, you're Colson Whitehead. He said, yeah, I am. And Colson, this is, you know, a long time ago. He was young, not as established. So whatever. I think he was surprised that Richard Ford knew who he was or recognized him. He said, you're Colson Whitehead. He said, yeah, and he spit in his face. And he said, you gave my book a bad review. Spit in his face and walked off. And, crazy thing to do, right?
Oh my god.
And they made page 6 of the New York Post. And so, this is how Colson got the better of it. They asked him, is it true Richard Ford spit in your face? He said, I'm not sure, you know, I'm used to old men drooling on me, so maybe that's what it was.
That's a perfect response. Yeah. Good for him.
Yeah.
Good for him. Wow.
So that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, that is a good one.
Another one, James Fry, that story. He wrote A Million Little Pieces.
Well, I know the story about A Million Little Pieces, but...
So before that book was exposed as a fraud,
yeah,
he was a huge deal, because, like, again, it was 2004, I know exactly when it was, and, you know, literary fiction and nonfiction, I guess, was more at the forefront of culture. So, like, he was on a lot of radio and TV and magazine stuff, and he talked shit about everybody. He was like, I'm the greatest writer. I'm the best writer since Hemingway, and all literary fiction sucks, and I'm great. And this is after, you know, he couldn't sell his novel, so he lied and said it was a memoir. And then there was an event where a bunch of us, those writers for John Kerry, it was like, we're going to get John Kerry elected with our literary fiction. Mm-hmm. So we raised money for John Kerry. And, you know, I think we did. I'm not sure. I think John Kerry won the election. I think literary fiction saved America. We didn't go to Iraq. So he was there, and he didn't sit with the rest of us. It was like, I think it was like Gary Steingart, people like that, and me and that. And he was like, I'm better than everyone, so he sat separately.
Wow.
And then the next day, it came out that his book was a total fraud. And the only reason it got published was because people couldn't believe the story, and he tried to sell it as a novel and couldn't because the prose was so bad. Yeah. So that was super satisfying. Yeah. Like the day after, he's like, "I wouldn't lower myself to sit with you."
Yeah, writer.
I think Hannah Tinty was there.
That's perfect.
Yeah. So,
well, yeah, that's very interesting, and you know, off stories.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's not that. They go around trying to meet people. It's just that when you're in it for a while, it's like, you know, I mentioned Hannah Tinty a few times. She was just a classmate of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned, I think, Karen Russell. She was a student of mine. Just when I first started, she's not that much younger than me, but, you know, I just started teaching, and she was like 6 years younger than me, five or six years younger than me, but she was my student. And, you know, you're in the game for a while, it happens. Like, I mentioned Gary Steingart. I think he was at Columbia when I was at NYU, and, you know, you just meet people.
And it is kind of a small world.
It's a very small world.
Which is interesting.
Colson, I mentioned, you know, he and I were in a poker game from before we were published.
That's cool.
It was a writer poker game. And, you know, it just so happened that many of us got published. But the poker game was started by Milo Goldberg, who wrote Beast Season. And it was me, Colson. It is. We still play. Me, Colson Whitehead, John Ray, Nathan Englander, Jonathan Lethem, and Hannah Tinty.
Wow.
So, you know.
Who usually wins?
Colson. He's a great poker player.
Like, really?
He wrote a book about poker. He, once I went to Atlantic City with me, him, and Nathan England, I went to Atlantic City. And, Nathan and I were just fucking around. He was like gone from like 9 to midnight playing poker. But that's the thing. Like, it wasn't like, oh, we're all gonna kiss each other's butt and become writers. Just
right.
Like, we're just
all
writers in town and liked poker. And, you know, it's a lonely, job in a way, right? Mm-hmm. That it's like, oh, well, we should play poker because we don't have an office to go to.
Right. Lucky you.
But yeah, no. No, it's great. Like, you know, those guys are all friends.
Yeah. No, that's really cool.
I'm sure your cohort, you know, there's a lot of talented people at NYU. Like, you know, and you got to help each other up. Like, once someone gets on the boat, you got to pull someone else up. That's what happened with David Foster Wallace and Jonathan Franzen.
Mm-hmm.
Where Wallace made it. And then made sure that Franzen got mentioned a lot. And that really is how Franzen made it. So
he's got a new book coming out, too.
I've heard it's really good.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing. So
I think people are gunning for it, but yeah. maybe it's good. I don't know.
Yeah. We'll see. But, I mean, it's awesome to have you here, and thanks so much for coming. And,
yeah, oh, wow, it's late, shit.
Yeah, I just looked down, I'm like, sorry to keep you for an hour and a half.
No, it was my pleasure.
Yeah, super excited about the thriller, and,
thanks, yeah.
And I'm also going to read Half a Life and have a nice talk with my dad and let you know how that goes.
Well, let me know what you think of it.
Yeah, I definitely will. Your prose is wonderful. I mean, just, it's thanks. Really, really, you know.
Thank you.
Refreshing to read, so.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. But, well, thanks so much for
my pleasure.
Making Selected Prose
better. I appreciate having you.
All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that. Like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you can. Definitely send those tweets to win the David Nutt book. And stay tuned for more episodes. We've got interviews with Gerald Brennan. And Big Bruiser Dope Boy coming in the near future. So very excited to share those with you. Have a good week. Enjoy writing. And we'll talk soon.